and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Andrew Smith and John Russell. Then, Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. Finally, you will hear the next part of our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Andrew Smith.
In Venezuela, people often must wait in long lines to get fuel for their vehicles. Fuel shortages are common because oil production has dropped in the country. Poor maintenance and lack of investment by Venezuela's state-owned oil industry are some reasons for the drop in production. In Maracaibo, a once wealthy oil city, two innovators have built small solar-powered and electric cars, and they are promoting the manufacture and use of these cars instead of vehicles that use fossil fuels. Jose Cintron is a 43-year-old electrical technician. He developed a solar-powered car. Augusto Pradelli, 61, created a small electric vehicle that can also use solar panels. Both cars are built on the frame of old golf carts with more powerful batteries. Cintron and Pradelli explain the benefits of solar energy. Pradelli said, "The beauty of solar charge is that as long as there is sun, the car is always charging. The sun is free, and that's what you have to take advantage of." And Cintron said, "Solar energy is the future. We have to stop relying on fossil fuels." He added that the change to solar energy will not happen in a very short period of time. And he said, "Oil is not going to go away that easily." Both of the small vehicles can carry 4 people and travel between 25 and 40 kilometers per hour. The batteries that power them can be recharged with solar panels in 10 hours. They can be charged more quickly by using an electric charging point, Pradelli said. The two men used their own money to build the small solar and electric cars. They hope to work together to develop a hybrid electric car. And they hope that one day the car will be produced nationally, a big dream in a country that was once one of the world's top oil producers. Maracaibo has a population of 2 million people. It is the second largest city in Venezuela. Temperatures there are over 34 degrees Celsius almost all year. The heat makes walking uncomfortable. That is another reason less costly electric vehicles are an appealing choice. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro saw Pradelli's car at a science and technology event last month. Pradelli said Maduro expressed his support of the vehicle. "The president told me, 'Augusto, I'll buy it from you,'" said Pradelli. He added that he told the president that he would need the support to produce it. He said that to manufacture the vehicles, and industry is necessary. I'm Andrew Smith.
A farm on the U.S.-Mexico border has become part of a larger disagreement between local, state, and federal governments. The disagreement centers on immigration enforcement on the southern border of the United States. The large pecan farm, known as Heavenly Farms, is owned by Hugo and Magali Urbina. They bought the farm, which is in Eagle Pass, Texas, in April 2021. The farm is in the U.S. Border Patrol's Del Rio sector, which is fast becoming the busiest area for illegal border crossings. Thousands of people pass each week onto the farm. The Urbinas at first welcomed a new chain-link fence placed on their property earlier this year. The fence was paid for by the state of Texas. It is part of Governor Greg Abbott's campaign to stop illegal border crossings along the Rio Grande River, which forms the border between Texas and Mexico. One day, the Urbinas found the fence's main gate unexpectedly locked. The lock was put there, they said, by Texas officials who have spent months arresting thousands of migrants on charges of illegally being on private land. But the Urbinas did not want the lock. The U.S. Border Patrol did not want the lock either. The federal agency said it hurt the agency's immigration enforcement efforts. The U.S. Border Patrol had it removed. Now one gate on the 1,200-mile Texas border has become part of a dispute about migration on America's southern border. But the Urbinas said they want no part of it. After the lock was removed last month, Governor Abbott criticized the action on social media. "Unbelievable," Abbott wrote. "While Texas secures the border, the federal government is enabling illegal immigration." The Urbinas do not oppose Abbott's campaign. But in the case of the lock, they said it went too far. They blamed what they see as a lack of a single command in an area with many state troopers, Texas National Guard members, U.S. Border Patrol agents, and local officials. Sometimes these groups work together. "They are all doing what they are being told," Magali Urbina said. "It is really not their fault, but there is no boss." Migrants had come to the Urbinas' farm long before the two bought it. Agents stopped migrants nearly 50,000 times in the Del Rio sector in July. About 6 of 10 stops in the Del Rio sector were migrants from Venezuela, Cuba, or Nicaragua. They were likely to be released to bring their immigration cases in U.S. courts because poor diplomatic relations with those countries mean the U.S. cannot, in some cases, send them home. Migrants cross the river and climb a few feet uphill into overgrown plants and concertina wire to surrender on the farm's edge. They expect to be released. U.S. Border Patrol agents, state troopers, and reporters are usually in the area. John Infanson is president of the National Border Patrol Council Union chapter that includes agents in Eagle Pass. "The governor is telling everyone, secure the border. I have no doubt that is the intent, but the reality of it is that it's just not that simple," Infanson said. I'm John Russell.
The American Space Agency, NASA, is celebrating the longest mission in its history. The mission involves two spacecraft, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. They launched in 1977. NASA officials have said that when first launched, the Voyager mission was expected to last 5 years. But both Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are still traveling and collecting valuable scientific data from the farthest reaches of space. The two spacecraft launched within weeks of each other in the summer of 1977. Last week marked the 45th anniversary of the launch of Voyager 1, on September 5th of that year. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 were designed to explore Jupiter and Saturn. Both spacecraft successfully carried out studies of those planets. Later, Voyager 2 completed the first-ever close observations of Uranus in 1986 and Neptune in 1989. The flyby trips involving the four planets became known as the Voyager Grand Tour. The two spacecraft then began a new mission to explore distant areas of space. In 2013, NASA announced that Voyager 1 had crossed over the border that divides our solar system from interstellar space. The term interstellar means between stars. Scientists say interstellar space begins where the sun's continuous flow of particles and its magnetic field stop. NASA said Voyager 2 first entered interstellar space in 2018. The spacecraft was more than 17.7 billion kilometers from the sun at the time. Both Voyagers are the only spacecraft so far to explore interstellar space. The two explorers have studied how the interstellar medium interacts with the solar wind, the continuous flow of charged particles released by the sun. They have also provided data about the heliosphere, a kind of protective bubble around our solar system. The heliosphere is created by the solar wind and is shaped and changed by interstellar conditions. The actual border of the solar system, the place where solar wind ends and interstellar space begins, is called the heliopause. NASA says the Voyager spacecraft have provided researchers with new information about interstellar space. For example, they discovered that cosmic rays are about 3 times more intense outside the heliopause than deep inside the heliosphere. Scientists have combined Voyager observations with data from newer missions to get a more complete picture of our sun and how the heliosphere interacts with interstellar space, NASA said. Last year, scientists reported that Voyager 1 had recorded a humming noise linked to waves discovered in small amounts of gas found in the near emptiness of interstellar space. Nicola Fox is the director of the Heliophysics Division at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. She said in a statement, "The Voyager's work has provided valuable information about the sun as well as the sun's influence throughout the whole solar system." Over the last 45 years, the Voyager missions have been integral in providing this knowledge and have helped change our understanding of the Sun and its influence in ways no other spacecraft can, Fox added. Each Voyager is powered by a thermoelectric power system containing plutonium. As the plutonium breaks down, the heat output drops and the Voyagers lose electricity. To make up for this, NASA said the team turned off all non-necessary systems and some once considered necessary. These include heaters that protect the still operating instruments from the extreme cold of space. But the space agency reports that all five of the instruments that had their heaters turned off since 2019 are still working. NASA scientists continue to wonder how the Voyagers continue to operate in temperatures which are far lower than they were designed for. I'm Brian Lynn.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we tell about the European settlers who established colonies in the American Northeast in the 1600s. Here is Steve Ember.
The Puritans were one of the largest groups from England to settle in the area known as Massachusetts. They began arriving in 1630. The Puritans had formed the Massachusetts Bay Company in England. The king had given the company an area of land between the Charles and Merrimack rivers. The Puritans were Protestant Christians who had split from the Anglican Church. They wanted to change the church to make it more holy, more pure in their eyes. The Puritans were able to live as they wanted in Massachusetts. Soon, they became that area's largest religious group. By 1690, 50,000 people were living in Massachusetts. Puritans thought their faith was the only true religion and that everyone should believe in it. They also believed that church leaders should lead the local government and that all people in the colony should pay to support the Puritan church. The Puritans thought it was the job of government leaders to tell people what to believe. But some people disagreed with the Puritans, who became leaders of the colony. One of those who disagreed was a Puritan minister named Roger Williams. Roger Williams believed, as all Puritans did, that other European religions were wrong. He thought the spiritual traditions of the Native Americans were wrong too, but he did not believe in trying to force others to agree with him. He thought that it was a sin to punish or kill anyone in the name of Christianity, and he thought that only members of the church should have to pay to support the church. Roger Williams began speaking and writing about his ideas. He wrote a book arguing that it was wrong to punish people for having different beliefs. Then he declared that the European settlers were stealing land that belonged to the Indians. He said the King of England had no right to let people settle on land that was not his. The Puritan leaders of the Massachusetts Bay Colony forced Roger Williams to leave the colony in 1636. He traveled south. He bought land from local Indians and started a city, Providence. The English Parliament gave him permission to establish a new colony, Rhode Island, with Providence as its capital. As a colony, Rhode Island accepted people of all religious beliefs, including Catholics, Quakers, Jews, and even people who did not believe in God. Roger Williams also believed that governments should have no connection to a church. This idea of separating church and state was new. Later, it would become one of the most important of all the governing principles of American democracy. Other colonies were started by people who left Massachusetts to seek land. One of those colonies was Connecticut. A group led by a Puritan minister named Thomas Hooker left Boston in 1636. They moved inland and settled near the Connecticut River. Others soon joined them. Other groups from Massachusetts traveled north to find new homes. The King of England had given two friends a large piece of land in the north. The friends divided it. John Mason took what became the colony of New Hampshire. Ferdinando Gorgas took the area that later became the state of Maine. Maine was never a colony. It remained a part of Massachusetts until the United States was established in 1776. The area that became New York State was settled by the Dutch. They called it New Netherland. Their home country, the Netherlands, was a great power with colonies all over the world. A business called the Dutch West India Company owned most of the colonies. The Dutch claimed American land because of explorations by Henry Hudson, an Englishman working for the Netherlands. The land the Dutch claimed was between the areas settled by the Puritans in the north and the Anglican tobacco farmers in the south. The Dutch were not interested in settling the territory. Instead, they wanted to earn money. The Dutch West India Company built trading posts on the rivers claimed by the Netherlands. Indians brought animal skins to these posts for use in making goods for buyers back in Europe. In 1626, the Dutch West India Company bought two islands from the local Indians. The islands were Manhattan and Long Island. The Dutch paid for Manhattan with goods worth only about $24. The Dutch West India Company tried to find people to settle in America, but few Dutch wanted to leave Europe. So the colony welcomed people from other colonies and other countries. These people built a town on Manhattan Island. They called it New Amsterdam. It was soon full of people who had arrived on ships from faraway places. Up until this time, the population was mostly Dutch and British, but now one could hear as many as 18 different languages spoken in New Amsterdam. In 1655, the governor of New Netherland took control of a nearby Swedish colony on Delaware Bay. 9 years later, the English did the same to the Dutch. The English seized control of New Amsterdam and renamed it New York. That ended Dutch control of the territory that is now the states of New York, New Jersey, and Delaware. Most of the Dutch in New Amsterdam did not leave after it became New York. The English allowed everyone to stay. They let the Dutch have religious freedom. The Dutch were just not in control anymore. The Duke of York owned the area now. He was the brother of King Charles II of England. The king gave some of the land near New York to two of his friends. Sir George Carteret and Lord John Berkeley established a colony. They called it New Jersey after the English island where Carteret was born. The two men wrote a plan of government for their colony. It created an assembly that represented the settlers. It provided for freedom of religion. Men could vote in New Jersey, whatever their religion. Soon, people from all parts of Europe were living in New Jersey. Then King Charles took control of the area. He sent a royal governor to rule. But the colonists were still allowed to make their own laws through their elected assembly. The King of England did the same in each colony he controlled. He collected taxes from the people who lived there, but allowed them to govern themselves. One religious group that was not welcome in England was the Quakers. Quakers call themselves Friends. They believe that everyone has an inner light that leads them to God. Quakers believe they do not need a religious leader to tell them what is right, so they had no clergy. Quakers believe that all people are equal. The Quakers in England refused to recognize the king as more important than anyone else. They also refused to pay taxes to support the Anglican Church. Quakers believe that killing is always wrong, so they would not fight even when they were forced to join the army. They also refused to promise their loyalty to a king or a government or a flag, only to God. For all these reasons, the English did not like the Quakers. Many Quakers wanted to leave England, but they were not welcome in most of the American colonies. One Quaker found a solution. His name was William Penn. William Penn was not born a Quaker. He became one as a young man. His father was an Anglican and a good friend of the king. King Charles borrowed money from William's father. When his father died, William Penn asked that the debt be paid with land in America. In 1681, the king gave William Penn land, which the king's council named Pennsylvania, meaning Penn's Woods in Latin. The Quakers now had their own colony. William Penn said the colony should be a place where everyone could live by Quaker ideas. That meant treating all people as equals and honoring all religions. It also meant that anyone could be elected as a leader. In most other colonies, people could believe in any religion, but they could not vote or hold office unless they were a member of the majority church. In Pennsylvania, all religions were equal.
And that's our program for today.
Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.